Welcome to Photo Geek Weekly. This is episode 43. We're recording it on October 25th, 2018. And I am so delighted to have a friend and really, I can call you a photo geek. We really go into the weeds. We go down the rabbit holes on so many different topics. And thank you so much for being back on another episode of this crazy adventure here. Martin Bearley, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Don. It's a pleasure to be called a geek by you, because I know that we're brothers in arms in this one. So although, you know, you're more like the colonel and I'm one of the foot soldiers, but
yeah, I don't know about that. I mean, we each have our strengths. And early on, and in fact, I mean, you've been doing your podcast for many years. And I remember when I first started my career, we were bantering back and forth about this a little bit before we started recording. I listened to your podcast as one of the inspirations for me to start getting geekier and understanding and kind of digging under the hood in photography. So I've got a lot to thank you for.
Oh, no, that's brilliant. No, thank you.
Yeah. Well, how long have you been doing your podcast now?
It's just, let's see, just over 16 years, I think it is. 2005, so 13 years. 2005, it's about 13, coming up just over 13 years.
Well, I typically make the marker of my professional career starting as a photographer as January 11th of 2009, which is where I made an image of red maple leaves on a bed of fresh snow in the shape of the Canadian flag. And that was the first real creative idea that I came up with and executed properly. And that I'm coming up on the 10-year anniversary to that. And so I was listening to you before then. So I'm trying to pay this pay something back to you in terms of thanks. And so but also thank you for being here, Martin. And we've got some fun stories to talk about. But before we get to those, it's been a while since we conversed. I know you take all sorts of images in nature and otherwise, and you do workshops. You are a multifaceted, wearing many hats kind of business person, such as I am as a photographer. So what keeps you busy these days?
I've actually just finished a relatively busy summer. Because the summers are so hot here in Tokyo, I generally sort of reverse hibernate. And this year's summer project was updating my Photographer's Friend app. So I've just released a new version of that. And it's basically I added a third calculator. So now we've got an exposure shift calculator. So when you move one, you set it with your camera settings and then you lock the dials. And when you move, say, the shutter speed, it automatically will calculate a new ISO or a new aperture for you, things like that. And that was a request from someone last year, and I spent the summer months doing that. I've otherwise been just catching up on things. I've got a new ebook that I've started to work on, and now as the winter season approaches, I'm working hard, sort of gathering the information on the customers that are, or the clients that are going to be coming on my winter workshops. I'm in Morocco in a few weeks as well, so busy.
Yeah, well, like I said, man of many hats. And your Photographer's Friends app is quite useful. I had it on my iPhone and I've just switched to Android because I've got the Red Hydrogen smartphone now in my pocket. And thank you for the reminder that I need to re-download that, because I used to show that to students as a valuable learning tool. And I think I've made you a couple of dollars at least from that, because they were pretty impressed.
Yeah, well, the learning aspect of it, I mean, to be 1,000,000% truthful about this, I rarely use a depth of field calculator in the field these days, because you learn how much depth of field you get and you don't need to rely on them so much, but
you get a feel for it.
But I find that explaining to people, with being able to show them those numbers and of course the app, I specifically made it so that you can run it on an iPad as well as an iPhone, and it all relays out nicely. So an iPad, I mean, I've got an iPad Pro, and I will sit on workshops and just show that big 13-inch screen, you know, for an iPad big, and just show it around. And people can really grasp the numbers. And that's really another reason why the exposure shift calculator was a priority for me this year, because that's really important for showing people how each of the settings affects the others.
Oh, exactly. And I should mention, you mentioned iPhone and iPad. You do have an Android version, right?
I don't. I'm working on. You know what? I've got a bit of software. I'm working on implementing something that will allow me to port it. So I'm hoping to get something available relatively soon.
All right. I'll be holding my breath. Don't make me turn blue.
I'll try.
All right. Let's get into some of the stories here, and we can keep the conversation going and the offside banter as we go through it, because I'm sure some of this will come up. But the first story, and this was, I'm kind of reveling in a failure here. It just, I mean, I did not support this Kickstarter campaign. I almost did, because I thought it would be just something of an anachronism. But this article from Petapixel says, Yashica's unexpected Y35 camera is worse than anyone expected. Now, first question for you, Martin. Do you pronounce it Yashica or Yashica?
It's Yashica.
Yashica. Okay. And yeah. Is that coming from you as a Brit or living in Japan?
That's coming from my Japanese side. Okay. So, yeah, I've actually got a Yashica camera, one of the twin lens reflex cameras. That was made in, I think, the early 80s or late 70s. And it's a great camera, but it was from the original Yashica and not the people that acquired them.
Yeah, the brand name has been purchased by some Chinese manufacturer. I don't even see their name in this particular article, nor could I remember it, and it's not important. But what is important is that almost 7,000 people backed this project. To bring a camera that, if you're not familiar with the Y35, it has no LCD screen on the back, but it is a digital camera. But to change camera settings, you would load in a film canister, a fake film canister, that would have settings preloaded into that canister. So if you wanted to set your ISO to 1600, there would be a film canister for that, or for black and white photography. And so all of these, they called a digifilm, would bring back the era of film where it would be inconvenient to change something like ISO, and you would just kind of be a bare bones kind of shooter. Now, bare bones is, they take it much farther than that. I hope I can get through this without laughing too much. The article lists some of the issues and complaints being shared. Okay, number one, the camera turns off when the shutter is pressed. I'd call that an issue. The camera doesn't even turn on. Okay, well, I can give that. Maybe there's a few lemons out there, and we'll set that in the wash, and they can get a replacement if they really want one. The camera is plastic and cheaply made. Camera parts are breaking and falling off. Fake buttons molded onto the plastic just for looks. The camera is hard to hold while pressing the shutter. Many backers have yet to receive their cameras, and they haven't gotten any updates on their status. Now, this is not uncommon for a Kickstarter campaign, as people are scrambling to fill orders. But the awful image quality, comparable to cheap toy cameras for kids, is definitely worth noting. Incorrect labeling on the fake film rolls, resulting in mismatched photo styles, which relates to the next comment of black and white photos coming out blue. An unreliable shutter button that doesn't always trigger a photo when pressed. Oh, this is a great one. The shutter takes the photo on the way up instead of when it's fully pressed down. Isn't that such a lovely feature? The shutter button is so stiff that it's unusable. The winding lever gets jammed and needs to be manually pushed back. The stickers on the camera have bubbles and are defective. Photos can't be found after they're captured. Difficulty inserting the digifilm rolls into the camera. This is classic. Removing the lens cover causes the lens to separate from the camera body. The included cable isn't compatible with the camera, and the photos are out of focus and distorted. Does this seem like a camera you want to buy, Martin?
I would love one, just so that I could tell people that I've got one of these incredible cameras. It's
like, after reading this, I so hope I can pick up one of these for $50 on eBay. This is just something that I want to sit on a shelf in my classroom as a showcase of a failure, and maybe it'll come to that at some point.
Yeah, you know, I think it's one of those things that, you know, unfortunately, occasionally there are Kickstarter projects that are they turn into lemons or whatever you want to call them. But I think with this, I mean, it's unfortunate that a quality. I mean, Yashka was never the. It wasn't a top name, but they made good cameras back in the day. And it's unfortunate that the name has been associated with this camera. But I mean, it says in the notes that it's some people are saying that this was just a scam to begin with. I'm not quite sure it was launched as a scam, but it certainly feels as though it's leaning towards one. The fact that some of the buttons are just plastic molded, this reminds me of it wasn't a scam with me either, but I reminded myself of when I was young, I went to the seaside in England and I bought what at the time digital watches were just becoming popular. And I bought this, what looked like a digital watch with a digital readout and an analog readout on the same watch face. And I thought, oh, that looks pretty cool. And I bought it in the shop and I quickly, like an hour later, I was in a bar and a guy at the sitting along the bar came and said, have you got the time? And I didn't recognize him at first, but I said, yeah, well, I would have. I said, but some whatever, I won't repeat the word, has just sold me what I thought was a digital watch. And it's just it's an analog watch with a sticker on it. And it turned out that it was just the digital part was just a sticker on the face. And the guy turned to me and said, that was me. It was the guy from the watch shop that was sitting drinking the money he'd made from my watch sale. But yeah, I mean, it seems very, very sort of poor business practice. And, you know, I can't help thinking that if I had, I wouldn't mind one now, just for, like you said, for the novelty factor. But I feel for the people that back this, hoping to get something that carried on the Yashka name, because I know a lot of people, you know, people our age, either their dads, or I mean, I'm probably 10 years or so older than you, so I mean, I might have had one of these in my late teens, but it's like people actually had and liked their Yashka cameras, and it wouldn't surprise me if at least a few people have backed this with a trip down memory lane, thinking, oh, I got another Yashka, and it's a new one, it's digital. And it really isn't. It's just the name, and it's unfortunate that it's been associated in this way.
I completely agree. But before we go on, Martin, I have to hear the end of that story.
What, the one with the watch?
Of course. Did you get a refund? What did the guy say after that?
It was really cheap anyway. I should have checked myself, but he just looked upset, and I was probably embarrassed that I'd just called him a name to his face. But I didn't ask for my money back or anything, but it was a really strange thing to do, especially because I'm so bad with names, not names, with faces. You know, I can mix two people up to really eat, like two totally different people, and I think they're the same person for years. And it's just, I've probably got that disorder, like, is it Brad Pitt or someone that can't recognize faces properly?
Oh, don't advertise this too much. It makes me want to play a game with you.
Well, I used to think that there's, is it Uma Thurman or Uma Thurman? And one other woman that looks just like her. I forget her name now. But I used to think they were the same person. And it's like, it's terrible because they're totally different.
I've had at least five or six celebrity things where I've thought, yeah, that has to be this guy. But no, it's a completely different actor, 10 years difference in age, and I just couldn't get it either. So maybe I've got the same thing. But
yeah,
it's really sad to see that the Yashka brand is being tarnished in such a way. Now, it could have been something that could have gone on. Maybe, you know, this was a first run and they had a lot of money to make this better and bigger and more film canisters and make it compatible to a second generation, et cetera, et cetera. It could have had that level of promise, even though I wouldn't have put a huge level of success in the product as we saw it. But I watched a teardown where people were taking this camera apart. And there were big slabs of metal inside the camera body that served no purpose other than to make it heavier. And the lens barrel that you see, the actual lens is about a third of that diameter, just a tiny little thing inside, and it's just hollow plastic.
It's almost like a phone lens, isn't it? It's
like a security camera or a toy camera for a child, as they had mentioned. It's no better in quality than that. And so, you know, I look at this and I see if those were their design specs to begin with, and I'm looking at the promo photos and they match what was delivered, then they weren't planning on delivering anything better than that. So it's bothersome. But that leads into a related story, something that was kind of pseudo-announced. I found this story on DP Review called Pixie. It is a displayless digital rangefinder that connects to your smartphone. And looking at this, this is a much more polished version of what the Yashica failed rebirth was. But it takes M lenses, like an M mount, and so you can put interchangeable lenses on this camera. There's no screen on the back, but there's a nice LCD display on the top showing you your camera settings and some other information like you would find on a lot of pro-level cameras. It's a rangefinder style, so you have an eyepiece that you can look through, much like the Leica M-series camera bodies. It is pretty simple, no nonsense. We don't have information on pricing and availability and everything yet. They haven't announced a Kickstarter campaign yet, which I find surprising because this is the kind of product that will probably go that route. They might in the future. But this, I think, is the Yashica camera that people wanted, right? This is what they were trying to put money down, and it's probably going to be more than the $150 per camera that Yashica Kickstarter was campaigning on. But what do you think about this as a concept, as a brand new upstart company, not associated with any defunct camera brand? And do they have any potential for success in the market?
I think that the camera itself, I mean, it actually looks pretty good. It doesn't look as though any of the knobs are just molded there for show. It looks pretty functional. It looks quite sleek, actually. The thing that I will say that they probably should either provide or someone will make, if this becomes a production camera, they need something that is, you know, like the hand grip on a digital SLR or an SLR camera. It's like the Yashica, because it's flat, you need something to wrap your fingers around when you press the shutter button, or you'll be fumbling with it.
That's a great observation. There's been a lot of third-party manufacturers that have made extended grips or bigger grips for some of these smaller cameras in the past, Micro Four Thirds and some of the Fuji cameras and even the Sony cameras, because that grip is really helpful for you to just get a proper hold of the camera. When your thumb is moving about trying to control things, all you're holding it onto is the palm of your hand and your fingers, and that needs to be a secure connection.
Yeah, and I think that is something that immediately, looking at the shape of it, it's sleek, and I think that it will probably be a good seller, but ergonomically, you need something to wrap your fingers around when you're pressing the shutter button, or it becomes difficult to press. But I can't imagine this releasing the shutter as you lift your finger as opposed to pushing it down or things like that.
It does seem a lot more polished, and they haven't announced a whole lot about the specs of the camera. There's some very pretty pictures, and it looks like it would be a fun camera to use if you can hold it properly. And I know we'll be seeing more from this project in the future, and we got to keep our finger on the pulse of that. But it also comes out at almost exactly the same time as Leica has announced the M10-D, which is a Wi-Fi powered rangefinder finder that has no LCD. And it's not the first LCD-less camera that Leica has produced, but they have an app that they have been perfecting over the last little while that will allow you to control the camera in a much more precise way than the knobs and the dials on the camera itself will allow. And this is, okay, I have a hard time looking at the price tag of $8,000 US and associating that with value as a photographer. It doesn't compute to me, especially for something that is trying to be kitschy, niche. You know, it embodies the hipster lifestyle. I mean, that's what they're going after. And simplicity is beautiful in photography. I completely agree, but not necessarily at this price. Well, I got to ask just generally what your opinion is, Martin, of the Leica M digital rangefinders, screen or no screen, and their price points. Is this something that you would ever recommend somebody going out to buy?
I think that, you know, the Leica brand is something that a lot of people lust after. And I would, in all honesty, I'd love a Leica camera. But it, the price of them is always going to be, for me, something that, and it's always been this way. You know, it's like I don't know if you remember, what was the movie where there was a guy, oh Jesus, all of my memories are going away. I must be getting older than I thought. There was a guy in this movie, he was a doctor, and he'd lost his Leica. And it seems like, you know, most of the people that buy Leicas are dentists, doctors, or professionals that make a lot of money. And I just think that that's the lifestyle that is associated with me, at least, with Leica. People in very sort of high-level jobs, high-level professions are the people that buy them. And, you know, I mean, I know a number of people that own a Leica, and they really did for many years saved up, and then they finally got it. But, you know, in the film days, I can relate to that, because when we bought a camera in the film days, it wasn't obsolete in 2 to 3 years when the next great version came out. Now cameras are becoming much more of a commodity. And paying $7,000 or $8,000 for a camera that you're going to replace in 2 or 3 years is not as acceptable to most people now. Luckily, I mean, for me, with me living in Tokyo, there's a store in town called Map Camera, MAP Camera, and they actually buy used lenses and bodies at such a high price that, to me, I could probably buy Leicas and replace them every 3 years and only be paying a relatively small amount, because they give you so much for a secondhand body. And, you know, so I could probably do this, but even then, to me, it just seems like too much money. And in all honesty, I don't really think, as though, although people say, oh yeah, it's got that Leica look and things like that, the images, you really are going to have a hard time telling the difference between the photos that come out of a Leica and any other, you know, relatively good, or I mean, even a relatively bad DSLR these days is going to make images that are comparable. So I really couldn't justify something like this.
Yeah, and but to some people that want that purest form, they want to go back to the era of film that they know and they love, or maybe they want to rediscover, but they want to do it in a digital context. I think that is the market for this, so long as you have the budget to afford it. Now, I had seen some leaked images of this camera beforehand, and people were looking at this lever on the top of the camera, and it looked like a film advanced lever, identical to what you would find on a film Leica. And that was really intriguing for me. And it turns out it does move out, and it's just a grip or a finger rest. And that is just such a missed opportunity, because they are pioneering this as that, you know, a nostalgia kind of reimagining what you thought film photography was in the digital era. But I have to hark back, and I got to give a shout out to Epson, which we don't think about as a camera manufacturer very much, but Epson came out with the RD1, and this was back in 2004, and it had what looked like a film advanced lever. What it was doing, and it was functional, is it would cock the shutter. So you are manually cocking the shutter with your hand, which means that the battery of the camera doesn't have to do that. So battery efficiency is preserved. And of course, if you don't have a screen on a camera like the Leica, then the battery should last conceivably for an incredible amount of time. They didn't do that. But it has been done before. It has been done almost 15 years ago now. And I look back at the RD1, and I just pulled up the Wikipedia page. They released it in 2004. And then subsequently, they created a new version of it that was effectively a firmware update, because they couldn't do that at the time. So they released a new version of it that added a few extra features like JPEG plus RAW and Adobe RGB, etc. Then they came out with the RD1X, which had a slightly bigger LCD screen, support for higher capacity SD cards. They stopped production of that in 2014. Mm. I'm still trying to wrap my head around this. Virtually unchanged digital camera on the market for 10 years. And if you look these cameras up on eBay right now, they are over $1,000 for a 6-megapixel camera that effectively debuted in 2004. So I look at that and I think, okay, that it's an anachronism. That's not everything. And this is a very unusual example. But that film advance lever functionally cocking the shutter of the camera offers people such satisfaction and such novelty to do so that it still garners a high price. I think Leica missed the mark on that one point here with this camera.
Yeah. You know, I think that it goes back as well to the Yashica that we were just talking about. I actually think that the idea that they had with the film canisters that changed the film styles, I think that's a relatively novel idea. And when we were talking about it, I recalled that a few years ago, there was a time, I think it was when I was using a 21 megapixel camera, that I found a card. I forget exactly. It was probably like a 512 megabyte card or something. I've got a pouch full of all of the old CF cards that I've used over the years. And one of them, I can't remember the exact size, but one of them gave me exactly 36 frames. And I was thinking, that's a roll of film, right? And so as an exercise, I was thinking, wouldn't it be great to do a workshop where everybody had a one memory card and you weren't allowed to delete them and you had to go out and come back with at least one world-beating photo out of 36. And that's how we used to shoot. You know, we'd got the limitations. We could take another roll of film, of course, but it was one of those things. And I think that there's a certain novelty, but also a little bit of a sort of developing the discipline involved in limitations like that. You know, we used to talk about taping the lens at 50 millimeters and stuff like that. I don't think that that's necessary, but it, as a way to develop skills and to become better at specific things, but imposing limitations on yourself is one thing that is worth doing from time to time. And I think that, again, it comes back to this Leica having no LCD. I personally wouldn't buy a digital camera that doesn't have an LCD. And it's not because I couldn't shoot with it. I like using the information that we get. I rely heavily on the histogram. And that's not because I'm not a very good photographer. It's because I shoot in a way that I require that information, you know, exposing to the right and all of that. And so, you know, we've got the technology to make such great photos that taking some of that away has to have some other benefit. And in my mind, one of them is this sort of developing a discipline, becoming more disciplined with your photography. But for me, I mean, coming back to the Leica again, is that worth $8,000? If I was going to buy a Leica, I'd definitely get one with an LCD on it.
Absolutely. Me too. And of course they make them, but at the same time, you know, I've been trying to get a good copy of a Leica Stemar lens, STEMAR, if you're looking them up. This is a stereo 3D macro, or not macro lens, but it can get pretty close. I just actually published an article today on Petapixel about 3D macro photography, and I love to explore 3D. It's a niche of mine, and very few people have done a full frame 3D macro lens very well. There's a company in the Netherlands that has done that, and Leica made one in, I think, 1954 is when they went into mass production. And they had some wartime prototypes that if I can spend what I would on a car, I could get one of those. But I bought one and it had fungus in the lens, and I'm sending it back to the person I bought it from right now after I tried to have it professionally cleaned, but fungus can etch or deteriorate the coatings on a lens and you can't really recover from that. So those lenses are multiple thousands of dollars. But no lens in modern history can do exactly the same thing. And I'm looking to buy into the The Panasonic full-frame cameras. The S1R is on my shopping list this Christmas or whenever it's available. They say 2019, whenever it is. But that is my next new camera. And I'm thinking to myself, well, I want to explore more of this 3D stuff. Who makes a lens? I don't care the brand. Oh, crap, it's Leica. and it's an old one and they didn't make very many of them. So it becomes a collector's piece and I might have to pay the price for that. But if I do and I use it for a few years and then want to sell it again, it's not like modern technology that devalues over time. It will maintain its same value over time, possibly even increase. So I just got to find myself a good copy. Anybody listening that has a Leica Steamar lens that is willing to part with it, please get in touch with me and I'm willing to make a deal. So anyhow, let's move on to the next story. I know, Martin, you are a Canon shooter. Yeah. And in general, before we get into the story at hand, what is your opinion of the Canon EOS R?
I think it piqued my interest just a little bit when I first saw the stories on this. And I'd like one, but not to the point where I'm going to buy one. I'd like one if it was handed to me and someone said, "Here, Martin, use this, and here's a couple of lenses for it as well." But if it was the only Canon camera I was going to buy, I would be relatively happy with it. Of course, they don't have the super telephoto lenses for it at the moment, but apparently the 50mm that they're making for it is really good quality. There's a good lens sort of range in the wide to sort of mid range zoom, and so if that's all you need, it's definitely something that you could consider. It's 30 megapixels or so, I think, which is great compared to a few years ago. Now I'm shooting 50 megapixels. I've become a bit of a I've always been, I want to say pixel whore, but that probably would require you to make some changes in the editing.
Resolution snob, let's go with that.
Yes, that'll do. So I've become a bit of a resolution snob. I've got problems sort of trying to maintain two systems. And this is another reason why I don't own a mirrorless camera yet, because if I'm going to buy something, right now when I travel, I use, even for wildlife work now, I use an 18-liter backpack, and I can fit in there two bodies and all of my lenses. And I can do that because both bodies take the same lenses. If I was to buy an R, then I would either have to buy and carry second lenses, or, they've got adapters for them.
The adapters look really good. And I have to just interject here, because those adapters, they should give you comparable focus performance and image quality as they would on a flapping mirror kind of camera like you have right now. But if you have a lens specifically designed for the R, it will provide you with better image quality based on the same engineering effort lesser engineering effort and thereby lesser cost at the same quality that you would be getting today. And so that's a fun trade-off that we get with the mirrorless market.
The thing is if I'm going to use it with my current lenses, I'm not going to benefit on size and weight really, because it's the camera itself is not that big a difference. And so for me, it's one of these things that it's interesting. I don't think that it's going to flop or anything. They've probably got a good camera on their hands. Personally, at the moment, I don't need it.
They have said, or I don't know if they've said, but there are rumors floating around that there is a higher end version of the EOS R camera coming out in the near future. I'm going to say within the next year, we'll see an announcement. I don't know what availability is. I don't have inside knowledge on this, but the concept of the EOS R, I think, is very nice for Canon shooters to advance into this mirrorless market without having to ditch all of the lenses that you already have. You adapt the ones that you have, and then you replace them as is necessary as new lenses come apart or come about. But in this case, I'm getting ahead of myself. Apart, I'm thinking the article that we found is a teardown of the Canon EOS R by Lens Rentals. And Roger at Lens Rentals, I love these articles. I don't know if you've read these before, Martin, but
I have. Yeah.
He takes apart cameras and just goes into the minutiae of every little quirk, interesting point to comment about every component inside of a camera, not on the outside, not the buttons and dials and menus. And so it's something fun to geek out about. And there are a few interesting takeaways about this particular camera. Number one, Canon has not built in-body image stabilization into their camera. And Roger seems to think that they won't do that in their next body. I'm on the fence on that. I think they have the ability, they've got the room to do it at the very least, because the body has a lot of physical space inside. If you look at a side profile shot of this camera, there's gaps between the boards and things that if this was engineered to the nines to be as good as it could possibly be, I don't think you would find space in there. And so that kind of tells me that there's more coming, that there's more advanced designs that are in the works, and this one is not the cream of the crop. But what was also surprising to me is the doors, like the battery door and the memory card door, et cetera, and all the knobs and the dials, they are gasketed for weather sealing. But where the plastic, like the top part of the camera meets the back of the camera, and you have these plastic components that are interconnecting, there's no weather sealing whatsoever in that area. Mm. And I think they commented that the same was true of some Sony cameras too. Is weather sealing that important to you? I mean, are you going out in a torrential downpour to try and get the best shot? And are you afraid to break the camera? Is that a non-starter, or are you just waiting for the next pro model that might cover all of these bases and make you say, all right, now it's time to switch?
I think I'm leaning more to the latter, but weather sealing to me is important, but coming back to the resolution snob sort of thing, I used to shoot with Canon's One Series cameras, and they are weather sealed. I've walked through semi-tropical forests that are pouring with rain, and I've had a lens and a body just hanging over my, hanging around my neck or sitting on the tripod, getting absolutely drenched, and they just keep going. But they were One Series bodies with L lenses on. Now, I mean, the 5D Mark III, I actually tested it. I was traveling with a guy called Tim Folmer, great photographer, does tours all around the world. And I was working with him in Iceland for 4 years in a row. And Tim said to me, oh, yeah, the 5Ds are fine in bad weather. You know, they're weatherproof. I said, no, they're not. And what happened was Canon said that the 5D Mark III was better weatherproof than the previous, than the Mark II. They didn't say it was weatherproof. It was just, it got better weatherproofing. And so I said to him, okay, watch this. And so one day in Iceland, it was absolutely chucking it down with rain. And I used my 5D Mark III just like a One Series. I had it around my neck the whole day. And after five hours, it died. And so basically, to prove a point, I killed my camera. Luckily, after 3 days of being wrapped in a towel in my bag and being aired each night, it did come back to life. But I killed the 5D Mark III in about 5 hours of torrential rain.
And the corrosion and things, they are continuous. I mean, it might have resurrected itself to be functional now, but that does not mean that it will be forever so.
Right. And, I mean, it worked until I sold it, but, to prove a point. And the thing is that they're not supposed to be weatherproof. Canon doesn't sell those as a weatherproof camera. The only cameras that Canon sells that are weatherproof are the One Series, and that remains today. So my 5Ds, here's the point, is that my 5D, I'm working with two 5D SR cameras now, and that neither of them are weatherproof. So I have to mollycoddle those cameras a little bit. If I'm working in rain, I have to keep some sort of a cover. What I normally do is just keep a cloth draped over them. That's enough. But I do have to mollycoddle them to a degree because they're not weatherproof. And although I don't like that, it's it's the price I have to pay for the resolution of those cameras.
Exactly. And you know, the next generation is going to probably supersede that 50 megapixel mark, or you'll get that in different flavors. Maybe they'll make a 1D series body that has that resolution, or maybe you'll find something in the EOS R market. The Panasonic S1R that I'll be getting my hands on whenever they're out is 47 megapixels, and that's comparable. So I don't know exactly what the weather sealing capabilities of that camera is going to be, but regardless, I will put it through the paces, and we'll see what comes of that. So let's move on to the next story, because we've got two more to get to. They're kind of fun ones. The next one I found from F-Stoppers, a video that is all about color science from Jared Undone. And color science is such a complicated topic, and to see a video that is around a dozen minutes long that tries to dissect color science and put it back together for people to understand was, you know, I raised an eyebrow and I watched the video, and I find it valuable. And I think that everybody that's listening should go to the show notes on photogeekweekly.com and take a look at this video, because color science can be very important to understanding what the camera is doing for interpreting light, for understanding exactly what it's seeing and showing us something that we might see as beautiful. And there is a science to that. But does the actual science matter at the end of the day? Martin, you and I are both sponsored by X-Rite. We are part of their Colorati program. And so that means that inherently, we care about color. We care about accuracy, particularly in printing, mind you. But that also flows back to how the image is captured to begin with. I don't do a lot of portraiture that requires a precise skin tone, nor do I do a lot of product photography where I have to match Pantone colors and things like that, where if you're off by a fraction of a degree, then you'll get a rejection from your client. But color science is still important because it tells us what we like about a photograph, but it also might show us how reality is different from what we like. Did you watch this video?
You know, I've got to admit, I didn't have time to. I read the article on it, but I didn't watch the video. I need to go back and look at that. It won't help us now, but yeah. I mean, color science, though, it's something that I do keep in mind. I have, I don't know if it goes into this, but I mean, I even when I'm composing shots, I will consider the human reaction to the types of colors in an image, for example. Many years ago, I figured out that I was attracted to a certain photograph of mine because the colors in it were exact opposites. If you look at them on a color wheel, one was like a orangey color, and the other one, it was surrounded by a pale blue. And I thought, there's something about the colors in this photo that are really appealing to me. And so I pulled up a color wheel, and I found that the two colors were exactly opposite. And then I realized that humans are being attracted to colors based on these sort of things. And then I looked even further, and it turns out that there's triads and all sorts that we find appealing. And that was something about the aesthetic qualities that are related to color science. But I don't think that that's exactly what this guy was going into.
Well, they do cover that, because you have a red, a green, and a blue filter over your sensor in different patterns. Fuji has their X-Trans sensors that use a different pattern than the standard Bayer filter array. And of course, there's the Foveon system, which is entirely different. Every pixel records the red, green, and blue as they are on that same pixel without being offset in physical space. So, but to understand color science is to become a color scientist and not a photographer. There is a divide between those two, because a lot of people will say, well, you know, we really like the Canon colors, we like the Nikon colors, or whatever it is. And okay, every company is going to interpret color slightly differently. And you've got picture styles on the Canon side that they mentioned in this video, that if you were to choose one of those specifically, you will get a certain feel. And the standard has been noted in many ways for having a certain appeal for portrait and street photographers and wedding photographers as well. I don't ever find value in defining the colors so abruptly. I do a lot of macro photography where the colors are often more vibrant and saturated than we would find in our own reality across the frame. Not to say that they're not accurate. They are. You find a very vibrant, you know, pink flower and you fill the frame with that. Well, then you are living in that, you know, pink magenta world for that photograph. And it doesn't really matter if that is 5% plus or minus what it should be, because I can adjust that to my taste afterward because I'm creating art, not necessarily documenting things. If you go back to the film era, people would choose their film emulsion based on the colors that it would produce for that particular film. You know, Velvia was famous for its very saturated colors. And, you know, I've got a roll sitting on my desk here of the new Kodak Ektachrome that has been re-released and is now available in 35 millimeter format. And I will be running that through a camera as soon as I find the time. And I'd be happy to see the results of that compared to what I see from my own eyes. Human vision is inherently not what a camera captures. Reality is subjective. And so when I look at what the camera captures, our job as photographers is to adjust what the camera captured to be similar to what we remember that scene to be. And that's also different from what it actually was, because we might remember it differently than it actually was. You know, if you had a cup of coffee that day or a cup of beer, it's going to affect your interpretation and your color and your enthusiasm of a particular scene. And so we have all these factors to consider. And I was just making some prints recently, one of them of a flower being electrocuted by 30,000 volts of electricity. Because why wouldn't you try that? And the purple colors that it produced, it was a mix of deep purples and deep blues, and it was almost impossible to recreate with my Canon printer, the IPF 8400. And you've got the newer version of that, Martin, the Pro 4000. I made a print thinking that everything is color calibrated to the nines. It's going to be perfect. And it came out and every color, like that subtle shift between the purples and the blues, was out of gamut. And it just came out all purple. So I had to do a bunch of small test prints, like a bunch of variations on that, and trying to show in Lightroom you can soft proof and see what stuff is out of gamut. And I tried to do all that. And I came out with about 8 different small, like 4x6 test prints that I printed. And I chose which one I liked the most out of all of those. And then I printed it still. It's all subjective. Everything that we do with color, it has to match what we want, not what reality is, because that is not the same thing. So if you like the colors out of your camera, congratulations, you don't have to mess with them. If you don't like them, then there are presets and there are lookup tables and there are ways for you to modify that to match what you do like. And it's not a big step to get there. But I still recommend anybody who's listening to this to watch this video. It's very informative for the behind the scenes on what the camera is doing. All right.
You know, I often think of photographs as like caricatures. You know, the cartoon caricatures where they'll do the head a lot bigger, or if it's someone that I don't know, they use their hands a lot, they'll probably make their hands twice as big as they should be, and things like that. And I think that the like, say for example, the Disney shows. When someone laughs, you get one of those people wearing a Minnie Mouse suit. When she laughs, her whole body moves, and the stomach goes in and out, and they sort of emphasize the movements to get across the message. And I think that a lot of the time in photographs, we as the artist deciding the colors has a certain amount of that to do as well. Because, for example, the ice on the beach in Iceland that I think we'll be talking about shortly as well. I've been to that beach a number of times, and the ice is blue and it looks really blue. But when you take, you know, you're in your images, your raw images, it's not quite that blue. So what do you do? Do you leave it there and say, okay, well, that's how the camera recorded it? Or do you enhance the blue and make maybe even over enhance the blue to get the image, the whole message across that this beach is full of blue ice? And I think, I always go to a point where I think it feels to me as though it's maybe a little bit over and then pull it back. And even then, it's probably bluer than people who are trying to sort of, I mean, for example, I had a photograph of the ice on that beach in an exhibition at Canon's headquarters. It's just been tore down. It was at in their showroom there for 6 months. And I was talking to my friend at Canon, and he said that a lot of people were saying, is the ice really that blue? And he said to me, is it really that blue? And I said, the camera doesn't think so, but my mind does. And when I'm looking at it, that's how blue I see it. But the camera is obviously recording it less blue than that. And so it's all really about how, like the caricature, to make someone look as though they speak with their hands a lot, just enhance it.
Yeah.
And I think that's a good way of getting the message across.
You put it so succinctly, I don't have anything else to add to that. So thank you, Martin. But you also made a nice segue into the final story that we're going to talk about, an ice lens. I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on this, but it is such a novel, fun concept where, you know, ice can be shaped into a particular form. I mean, I remember I gave as a gift a mold that would make an ice cube look like the Death Star a few Christmases ago to one of my relatives. Ice can be very easily molded, and it can function as a lens. So what if you were to take some iceberg ice and shape that into what would be useful as a lens in terms of the shape, and build it into what is a 3D printed shell, a lens barrel, if you will, and then start to take pictures of that. Is that something that your mad scientist mind, Martin, would have ever gone to?
Not really. I did watch this video, and it's great. But yeah, I mean, I personally wouldn't do this just because it's too much trouble for what I can imagine the results will be. And the results that he got were kind of confirmed that. But that's me, you know, and I think that this was a very creative project. Great to see and very well documented. So,
very well documented. And the images, they are very low quality in terms of the optical resolution, but they don't look like a pinhole camera. They have some optical quirks. Every image is different in terms of what distortions and whatever that you have. If you're a fan of lamography, then this is something you might want to consider.
Absolutely.
Immediately, though, I started thinking, I don't want water melting back into my camera from the lens. To me, that was a big non-starter. I'd have to put some sort of shield against that from happening. But I think this would be a really fun contest. Could you imagine a photo contest that has a big prize at the end of it, where you have to design your own lens, your own lens elements, like MasterChef style, and you're given the ingredients, you have to mold the elements, not just one, but possibly even mold an achromatic lens element or multiple groups, and you have, like, whatever, 5 minutes to shoot with it because it's going to melt and disappear in the interim. And to see the images created from something like that, that would be reality TV I would watch.
You know, a few years ago, I think it was on TWIP with Frederick. We were talking about a liquid lens. Maybe we spoke about it as well. I can't remember, but a lens that had been designed that was basically a little bag of liquid. And I never saw any more on this, but it was, you can imagine that it wouldn't be that difficult. Obviously, it's going to be, well, relatively difficult, but it's the idea behind this is pretty simple, in that you could create a clear pouch of either gel or like a less viscous liquid, and just pull it out in equal amounts around the sides to make it thinner, or push it in to make it, you know, make it sort of more round, and you could basically emulate the lens in our eyes do by doing pretty much the same thing. And it makes me wonder how much of a zoom you could create by making the water or the liquid a little bit fatter, and if there are any ways that could be used in a real lens.
Well, if you could imagine that a lens today, the lens elements are fixed in shape and they just change their orientation amongst each other, the distances and what have you in different groups to change the focal length of a zoom lens. So what if instead of or in conjunction with changing the distance between these, you change the shape of them?
Exactly. Yeah.
So in that case, then you would not have to sacrifice image quality because at certain focal lengths, it might not perform as well as others. You can modify the lens shape to make it perform equally across the board and possibly extend that zoom range even farther without compromising quality. And so I think that's still a theoretical thing. But the DIY just joy of making your own lens from ice, it makes me want to try it. It makes me want to just build a lens in my freezer and try to shoot with it just for the fun of it.
Because
I always have to bring photography. I'm a professional. Yes, I have to pay the bills with it, but I need to find ways to make it fun.
Yeah.
And the images I don't think would be award-winning or sellable in any way, but it would be a joy to just experiment. And so I had to add that in at the end of the episode.
Yeah. Have you ever used a pinhole camera? You just mentioned it.
I have. I actually have one designed by Chris Marquardt.
Oh, you bought one of those? Yeah, I remember. I remember that.
I have a Chris Marquardt International Pinhole. I own serial number one.
Wow.
So I've used that on occasion. It shoots on 4x5 sheets of film, and it does a pretty fun job. I even shot black and white film with colored filters in front of it and put them together as a colored image at the end with this pinhole camera. And it was a fun experiment.
I
will never sell that photograph. It's not valuable enough for that, but I loved the fun and just the, okay, what is going to happen as a result of this process? And that to me, I have to find more of that in photography, because if I don't, I'm not going to enjoy what I do.
Yeah. You know, I have a, I think it's made by Pentax. It's actually just it looks like a little pancake lens, but that's really essentially just a pinhole lens. It's like a lens cover with a hole in it. And I shoot with that occasionally, and I think they are fun. You know, and that's, like you say, that's really what it's all about a lot of the time. Just, that's why I find shooting with film to be really tedious, but it's fun and it's nostalgic. And occasionally I will just, the thing I use more than anything is I will get a roll of 120 medium format film and drop it into the Yashka that I mentioned earlier and just sling it around my neck, walk around town looking down into it, because you have to look down into there are ways to shoot with it other ways. But, and then it's, when you tilt the camera one way, the image goes the other way, and it's all just really wacky to do, and it's a lot of fun. So I'm totally with you on that. I think we need that occasionally.
Absolutely. Not all the time, because again, that's not as sellable as our modern cameras will produce our work for. But I think that it has to be a piece of the process, because it keeps us engaged, it keeps us curious, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And talking about curiosities, let's dig into our picks of the week real quick as we wind down this episode. Martin, I want you to go first, because this is really important. And photographers often sell themselves short on branding, and there is a very important branding mechanism that you're about to recommend.
Yeah. So, I've just literally a few days ago taken delivery of my fourth order from moo.com of my business cards. And I won't get them out and show you them, because I know that this is audio only. But basically what I did was, with Moo, you can select up to 50 different designs, 50 different images to have printed on what's essentially the back of your business card. And I think I did 29 or 30 different photos this time. But you put them in and then you tell them how many you want. I literally, at this time, this was the first time I've done it, but I had 400 business cards made, and they have 30 designs on. So some of them I've got like 5, 6, or I think maybe eight of these, eight copies of each image. But you end up with a box full of photos, and they're really, really good. The quality, the paper that they use is great. I have this like a rubberized, like raised over my logo, and over my name, I have this like clear rubber applied to them. So that,
oh, perfect, yeah.
So yeah, so when she rub your finger over my name, you can actually feel the characters. But the quality, they're really, really nice, and they are a good talking point. You know, I was whenever I give someone my cards, basically I'll say just pick a photo. And then they'll splay them out. You know, if I've got like a small box with me, they'll have maybe 10 to 15 to play with. If I'm handing out to a workshop group, I'll often just drop a box full on the table, and then people will take them out and they'll say, oh, I like that one and I want that one. And you end up with this whole conversation. And I know that it's very egotistical, but as a photographer, as a photographer, we have to have people look at our work. And I think it's really important to see the sort of reaction that people give to your work. And also, it's a good barometer, because you find that in the end, you will always have one type of image, one photograph that will be taken more often than others. And so it helps you to find out what people are finding appealing about your work as well. And for yourself, you know, if you order a box, I mean, I don't know, it depends how much you network, but if you order a box of, say, 200, and it takes you a year to hand those out, over that year, you will start to, when there are times when you don't give people a pick, you just pick one and give it to them. And as you look through your images, even yourself, your reaction to the images changes. So I had some photos of breaching whales on my last batch of cards from Greenland. And when I shot them and when I had those cards printed, I was really excited about these photos. But over the year or so that I was handing them out, it would go to the back of the pack pretty much all the time, because it didn't look that great on a business card. And so you learn about your images, you learn about people's reactions to them. And at the end of the day, they're really, really nice looking cards. So I give Moo.com a big thumbs up.
In their early days, they did not have the raised letters and things like that. And so now that they've improved that, and if you look, there's at least four different classes of products that you can go and buy, different materials and what have you, and then different options within that. So if you're looking for business cards, and seriously, I don't have my cards printed from them, but I get a lot of compliments on my cards. I've got spot gloss on the front and the back, where parts are glossy, part are matte. Mm. I have some foil stamping on the front side as well for my signature. And they're not cheap cards. They're really expensive. Mm. But people comment on them and they say, wow, these are nice cards. And I order them like 2,000 or 3,000 at a time. Mm. And when I do a presentation at a camera club or a conference, what have you, I will burn through hundreds of cards, because everybody wants to take one. And not everybody's going to contact me. And it costs me about 25 cents a card. So please don't take my cards unless you intend to use it for some reason. But it does echo that sentiment of, it is your brand. It is the takeaway. It's what people are going to leave thinking about you when they look at that again the next time they find it.
Yeah. I'm just checking the pricing on mine. For 400, it cost me £150, which is what, probably about $200. So we're not talking a lot of money for these. They're not as extravagant as I don't have the foil or whatever. I don't have anything like you had, but they're not the cheapest ones that Moo do either. And so, price-wise, they're pretty competitive, and the quality is great. So I've been very happy with them.
It is a great recommendation. Thank you very much, Martin. And mine won't take too long. Something I've talked about before is Adaptilux, and you'll find the links to that in the show notes for the picks of the week. They have these little control boxes that you can plug in up to 5 different lighting arms that could be white or really bright white. It could be a laser, ultraviolet, different colored lights, in order to, on a macro scale, light a subject with different lighting sources from different angles. And I've been a fan of them from their initial Kickstarter campaign, and they've just rolled out this Control Pod 2.0, which is much the same as the big the original one, although it's reinforced and it's got a slightly revised look. It has, to me, the most important feature, a boost mode. You press the plus button on this module for 3 seconds, and it triples the brightness of the output of anything you have attached to it. Wow. Yes, it's going to drain the battery down much faster than it would otherwise. But if you're struggling with higher ISOs or subjects that are moving, then just by dramatically increasing the light output, every control arm that I have works perfectly fine with the boost mode enabled. And I've gotten a sample of that to play with here from Sam. Thank you so much for that, Sam, for sending that to me. I think I might want to keep it. And to keep it, I'm going to have to pay for it. But it's such an advancement over the one that I had previously purchased that it becomes much more useful, especially for subjects like ultraviolet fluorescence that I'm a huge fan of, and I'm looking for cost-effective consumer products to explore, and it looks like they are on point for this one. So it's about 180 euro, including VAT. So for me, it would be less than that when I buy it. But the ControlPod 2.0 from Adaptilux, that is my pick of the week. And if you like macro photography, but you want to find a creative way to light your stuff that gives you a what you see is what you get output, you're looking through the viewfinder and you're seeing exactly what the image is going to be, I think this is a very viable option more now than ever. So that is my pick.
Sounds like nitroglycerin for photography, doesn't it?
Almost. Cool. Yeah, exactly. And so it just amps up your creativity in some really wonderful ways. So those are the picks. Now, Martin, where can people find you, your work, and more importantly, the workshops that people can interact with you personally and learn from you?
It's all linked at martinbaileyphotography.com. So if you go over there, there's a link for all of the blog posts, but the 99% of them have a podcast player in there. The next thing along is the tours and workshops, and everything that's currently available is there. And then you can check out my portfolios and all sorts of other stuff, and contact me as well. So it'd be great to hear from anyone that has an opinion or something to say about the show.
And those links are in the show notes for this episode. And please contact Martin. His opinions are valuable to me. They should be valuable to you. And just get into discussions with both of us about the stuff that we talk about. I'm sure, Martin, just like I am, you love to talk about this stuff to anybody that sends you an email and to keep these opinions and conversations going forward, because that creates kind of a relationship with the people that are listening to us.
Yeah, I always, unless it's spam or someone trying to sell me Photoshop clipping services, I reply to every mail that I get. So yeah, absolutely. I love talking with people about this stuff.
Perfect. Well, I think we'll leave it at that. And we've covered a broad number of topics on this episode. And thank you for going toe-to-toe with me on it, Martin. At this point, we'll have to say get out and shoot.